Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Praemium Investment Leader Series podcast. This program is brought to you by Praemium, one of Australia's leading investment platforms. We bring to you thought leaders from around the investment and funds management industry, and today's program will continue our focus on responsible investing. Whilst there's been a growing trend in this area in recent years, but a number of recent natural disasters have brought this to the forefront of our minds for investors. In today's podcast, we'll be talking about responsible investing and how fund managers incorporate it within their process with the aim of making a positive impact to our world and delivering returns to investors. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Stuart Palmer, Head of Ethics Research from Australian Ethical. Stuart has over 30 years' experience as both a lawyer and investment banker before joining Australian Ethical 5 years ago. And Australian Ethical was begun in 1986 and are providing ethical sustainable investment solutions. And today they manage just shy of $4 billion for over 45,000 super members and investors. So Stuart, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Damien.
So let's start with an opening question around ethical investment, because there's so many acronyms, there's so many different words to describe this space within SRI, ESG, responsible as well. Can you walk us through the different terminology that's used and I suppose the style of investing that they all have?
Yeah, so at the starting point is these are not precise terms. The umbrella term, I guess, often used is responsible investing, and as you've mentioned, SRI, sustainable. Ethical impact investing is talked about a lot these days.
Yep.
So caution needs to be exercised in just reading a style off a label. So you need to look behind the label and find out what approach is the fund or the manager taking to their investing. A good way, I think, of breaking it down is just to think about the different tools that investors have to have a positive influence on the economy and society, and that's a core objective of ethical investing, responsible investing, alongside generating those good financial returns, actually building a better future. And it's obviously at the core of ethical investing is where you put your capital and where you withhold it from. So that's obviously a key thing to look at. How are funds screening investments and companies in? How are they excluding them? But beyond that, there's also engagement and advocacy, which is really important. Responsible investors have a long-term perspective. They invest across the economy. So that mindset is a really valuable one to bring to the table for discussions, both with companies themselves, but also just out there in the public arena, talking about issues like climate change and what sort of policies and corporate behaviour might be needed to address those sorts of challenges. So it's looking at those things. What does the manager do that? How does it do it at all? And some funds, will do less of that. Some will do more. And I guess how do they bring it all together in just being transparent and disclosing to the end investor? This is the outcome of what you're achieving by investing with us. I mean, you can have anecdotes here or there about what we invested in this positive company or that positive company. We have this approach, but how is my portfolio? How does it look differently to a mainstream portfolio? Is it invested more in renewables? Is it driving better management of human rights risks in companies which have big supply chains in Southeast Asia and so on? So that is probably makes it sound complicated, but unfortunately I think it is. To try and boil it down, I mean, if you're looking to invest in a sustainable or ethical fund, the bedrock requirement needs to be that the fund or the manager needs to be transparent about what that means to them, what their offering is. If all you see is a label, then that should be ringing some alarm bells.
Yeah, correct. And I think this is what, part of the benefit of today's podcast and further work is that, to really get out there and talk about specific cases and how you've applied them all. Because you're right that there is some grey at times out of all of this here, and to be transparent about what's going on and letting investors know, I think is hugely important in this space. And I think you guys do a really good job of that one there.
Yep.
So when we talk about, I suppose, the screening process, you've got, this is one element that you could do about positive and negative screening.
Mm.
Yeah, that's one element. But let's have a look at, you know, assessing degrees of impact as well. So how do you bring all of that together in your portfolio and what you see out there?
Yeah, so people will think about ethical investing often, you know, a couple of very specific exclusions around tobacco, certain times of weapons and so on. And some ethical funds, that's all they do. But obviously other funds take a broader holistic approach to their portfolios like us. So we're looking at both positive and negative impacts and also, yeah, the different types of impact which companies have. I mean, if you think just about, say, social impact, for example, you've got, you know, positive products and services, which many companies provide, but if you're interested in the depth of that impact, then you should be also thinking about, well, okay, that's positive, but how positive? How much is it contributing to the well-being of people? How many people? You know, is it just a small group, or is it, you know, across society? And is it reaching the people who need it most? So yeah, if you're serving a pretty well-off part of the market, that's great, that's a good thing, but it's going to be less impactful than if you're delivering sort of basic goods and services to people who have limited access to those at the moment. But I guess the key is trying to think holistically about the positives and negatives. So you identify the positive impact, as we do. You've got to have a positive impact under our ethical charter before you're investable. But then that's not enough. You need to then look, okay, what's the footprint, environmental and social, of that? Because any activity is going to have some form of environmental or social impact. So, you know, has the company got a good product or service, and what's the impact of that? And then are they producing it, delivering it in a way which is appropriately managing those that footprint?
Yep. That's a really interesting point, I suppose, looking at the numerical impact in a way.
Hmm.
So some we'll talk about later, but again, you know, structurally talking about this space, I suppose the general assumption would be exclude certain industries, therefore it has a reduction in the investable universe, therefore you've got less tools at your disposal. So it'd be, you know, the conclusion would be that you've got less to work with, and therefore investment returns can get impacted as well. Mm-hmm. So we've got probably a lot more data now. Mm-hmm. If we go back 5-10 years mm-hmm. ago, maybe not as much. Mm-hmm. So what are you seeing now in terms of the investment experience in this space?
Yeah, and listen, I should start by acknowledging, you know, there's a logic to that concern. You're constraining the universe. Mm. Isn't that going to have a negative impact? I guess the other logic is, well, you know, if you're deeply understanding the risks and harms and positives associated with an investment, that's giving you a deeper understanding of particular sectors and companies and you know, identifying areas which are more growth opportunities and avoiding those areas which, you know, are a greater risk of having adverse consumer or government action. So I think your point is, what's the evidence telling us? And it's a very positive story for responsible investing. So the Responsible Investment Association of Australasia for many years has done an annual benchmark report where they look at responsible investment performance across different asset classes, 1, 3, 7, and 10 year periods, I think, and then sort of compare that to benchmarks, compare that to mainstream funds. It's a positive story for responsible investment across the majority of those different combinations. There's actually outperformance from the responsible investment strategies. Yep. So that's a good story. I mean, last year Morgan Stanley did some really interesting analysis looking at over 11,000 US mutual funds and over a long period, 2004-2018. And then picked up 400 sustainable funds within that large universe and compared their performance, and it found no difference in performance. I basically couldn't find under or over performance. What they did find positively for the sustainable funds was that they had better risk return characteristics in volatile volatile parts of the cycle that they actually perform better in, in those sorts of circumstances.
And I suppose a lot of active managers would make the claim or the assertion that looking at the sustainability of a company or an industry is paramount to their investment process anyway, irrespective of what label they may place on their investment strategy. Sustainability will always be at the impact. So there is always that natural contraction or restriction of the universe anyway that's happening for managers. So, yeah, I could see how that would go. Now, delving into some specifics, climate change, it's been a very topical, you know, for quite a period of time, but I think in recent times here in Australia, as I said, with a lot of natural disasters brought a very much the focal point, also what governments are doing about it as well, rather than just the talking point. And it is a key motivator for investors to start looking at responsible portfolios. I think that's, you know, in a way that it's, it does grasp their attention, feel like they need to do something about it. Can you talk through, I suppose, climate risks in portfolios and what you're doing in that space?
I mean, the energy sector is an obvious place to start. And our approach is to exclude fossil fuel companies. So we've been out of that sector. Happily, then we've avoided sort of the decimation we've seen of many coal stocks and more broadly oil and gas stocks. So the oil and gas sector, again last year, the year before was the lowest performing sector at the S&P 500. Looking back over a decade, I just read some research. You know, basically flat that sector over the last 10 years at a time when the S&P 500 has done 200%. So I think that is attracting a lot of interest from hard-nosed finance-focused investors alongside the dimension that you've mentioned that, you know, there's a level of frustration with inaction around the place in Australia. Can I actually be part of a solution to this great challenge? And it's not just the energy sector. Obviously, with increased temperature, violent weather, things like resilience of infrastructure, real estate is becoming a very important consideration in any sort of investment in the property sector, in the infrastructure sector, and so on. And it's becoming a base level expectation of really companies across the economy to be upfront and saying these are the implications of climate change for our business, and this is how we're going to play our role in a transition to zero emissions, which is going to help us limit it not to a safe level, because really we're past the level we would want to be already, but to limit it as far as we reasonably can.
And so on the zero emission target, so is there any companies that stick out that are doing some really good things in that space?
They're really good to see that there's a lot more companies who are at least giving the commitment to aligning their business with that zero emissions transition. The challenge is, okay, what does that transition look like? What does it mean for the individual company, and are they walking that talk? In the energy sector, we invest in Infigen Energy. We invest in Contact Energy in New Zealand. So, I mean, they're sort of obvious ones. They're, continuing to invest heavily in building their renewable energy generation capacity. But alongside that, energy efficiency technology companies, there's lots of opportunities there because, you know, if you can actually reduce the need to use the energy in the first place, that's even better than having to generate anything at all. There's a lot of focus. We don't invest in the big miners. We don't invest in the big oil and gas companies. But there is quite rightly a lot of focus on those companies. How are they transitioning? Because they are going to be key in terms of how they reduce their emissions. And we still engage with those companies and advocate with them. What we would hope is over time they will come within our ethical universe as they reshape their businesses.
And that's a wonderful segue is around advocacy and engagement in companies. I think, you can see the work that maybe stocks are in or out of portfolios. That's fine. That's clear. But in terms of potency as well, about the ability to engage with companies, either bring ideas to their agenda,
yeah,
or, you know, tell them your displeasure, mm, as well on these, mm, things. So can you talk us through, you know, some examples of advocacy and engagement, yeah, with companies specifically?
Yeah. So I think it is really important. I mean, investors invest, you know, across a whole range of industries. So they're not coming to the table as the subject matter experts on steel making or, yeah, food production. So it's a very much a two-way conversation, understanding the challenges within the sector. But I guess what investors do bring is that broader perspective. They're not sort of wrapped up in business as usual, as, you know, often, yep, boards and executives, even senior executives and boards get wrapped up in, and, you know, they have experience, their skill set is around, you know, the existing industry, the old way of doing things. So, you know, there's natural biases to you know, continue with that rather than, potentially, diverting into some newer areas which require different capacities, mm, and skills. So investors can push that conversation forward, and increasingly, you know, collaboration between investors and investor groups and civil society groups are doing a lot of great research about, yeah, what does low emissions hydrogen look like, hydrogen generated from renewable energy? What's the future of the steel making using hydrogen, for example, to reduce, eliminate the need for metallurgical coal to make steel, and so on? So, yeah, we come to the table and just ask the questions about that, and it's a level of, it's getting a view and getting a level of satisfaction that the company is seriously investigating these technologies and investing in them as appropriate, or telling, yeah, us why they're not. Yeah. So in terms of examples, and there's things investors do collaboratively. So the Climate Action 100 Plus is a global initiative in engaging with the biggest miners, the biggest energy companies, and so on. And we've seen some powerful commitments made by companies sort of as a result of that. But it's also individual work that individual investors do and civil society groups do. So I guess an example would be an Australian insurance company, QBE. So last year, Market Forces, an NGO, arranged a shareholder resolution calling on that company to do more to set out its plan for reducing its exposure to fossil fuels, coal, but also oil and gas. We co-filed that resolution, so we do invest in QBE, and we supported that resolution. Following the lodgement of the resolution, we saw QBE actually give a commitment, a time frame for phasing out its support for thermal coal. So that's both in how it invests, its insurance reserves, but also really importantly, you know, what it will underwrite in terms of new infrastructure. We felt that was really positive, didn't go far enough. So we progressed the resolution to the AGM because we wanted to have the conversation further about oil and gas. So what's the plan for that? Because, yep, I think there's an acceptance that, yeah, burning coal, you know, just the future for that is short. But oil and gas is equally in the firing line, as we're seeing in share prices and other measures. It needs to be managed out as well. So, we went to the AGM, a range of other shareholders, retail shareholders went there and, yeah, just put questions to the board. And we see increasingly the AGM as being, yeah, a really productive forum for these sorts of conversations to happen. The board's there, the senior executives there, retail investors are there. We think more institutional investors should be there, just to be part of that conversation. And it should be a conversation. It's not an opportunity for both sides just to shout at each other. It should be a conversation. And then shareholders get to vote on the resolution. Yeah. So
the owners of the company.
As the owners of the company.
No, could not agree more. So we talked about before about this program of negative screening, yeah, naturally could restrict your universe, but equally with all of the, I suppose, the positive energy that's going on in this space, it feels like that there's more and more companies out there in terms of that are giving you a positive inclusion within your portfolio. So are you seeing the universe of companies of interest expand in this space? And I suppose, yeah, the other element of it as well, when you look at between the listed and unlisted space and the tenure of some of these projects, what's going on in the listed markets, first of all, and then we could kind of touch on unlisted.
Yeah. So it's expanding to some extent. I mean, we've already mentioned the challenge of differentiating between the talk and the walk. So, you know, before we'll invest, we'll look for the commitment from the company to manage their impact appropriately. But then how's that being implemented? So we're seeing a lot more transparency, a lot more talk, which is fantastic. It's what we need.
Yep.
But we also need to look behind that and say, okay, is that being translated into real impact?
Yep.
And also, I guess it's fair to say that, you know, expectations of what counts as responsible business do change. You know, what was an acceptable response to climate change or human rights violations 5 years ago probably isn't going to pass the grade, you know, today, because the opportunities for companies to manage these risks and have positive impact have opened up for them.
Yep.
But I mean, I'm thinking of an example. I mean, it's tough for us, given our ethical charter, our deep consideration of all impacts on people, animals and the environment. The mining sector is a tough place for us to invest.
Yep.
But we will invest in lithium miners, for example.
Yep.
Obviously, lithium as a core mineral for batteries, part of that renewable energy transition of the energy sector and obviously of the auto sector. There's an asset class, there's a product there which is opened up, but equally the companies operating in that sector, they're recognising that they do to attract responsible investment and investors generally, they need to have more than just a positive thing they're pulling out of the ground.
Mm.
They need to have in place the processes to manage their impacts. Mining is going to have impacts on local communities, potential impacts on water, groundwater, potential, for accident, health and safety issues and so on. And pleasingly, even the smaller miners in those sorts of areas are doing a lot of work around, getting certified to appropriate standards, making sure they're consulting appropriately with all relevant stakeholders and reporting on all of that. So that definitely is an area where we've seen, you know, an expansion of our ethical universe.
Yep, yeah, no, definitely. The battery space would be a great one. That's probably wasn't there so much 5 years ago. That's now quite investable. And I know not quite in your sphere, but in the unlisted space, you know, listed companies, they've got a lot of, I suppose, concerns to deliver returns and update the market regularly, and they have a whole lot of shareholder pressure, which, you know, shortens up some of their investment timeframes. You can imagine in the unlisted space, the ability to kind of look at, you know, impact projects that don't have a payoff for 5 years that would probably never be tolerated in the listed space. Is there anything interesting that you've seen in unlisted impact kind of projects?
Yeah, there's one I'd love to talk about. Just to the point on the listed space, you're absolutely right. I guess what we push for, and I think investors generally should push for, big companies have the opportunity within their business to have impact style initiatives because they're big. So we're not talking about, you know, retooling the whole organization overnight, but a company like Unilever, you know, what can it do in terms of projects to raise the sustainability of their sourcing of various ingredients to their food products, for example. And they're an example who do some positive things in that area. Mm. And the valuable thing about that is that they're of a scale, if that works and it becomes a condition of their acquisition of a particular commodity, for example, that basically sets the bar for the market. Everyone wants to sell to Unilever, so it sort of raises the standard for the smaller companies. So I don't want to discount the impact that big companies can achieve and should be pushed or encouraged by responsible investors to achieve. But yeah, the unlisted space is really interesting and exciting. I mean, through our balance fund, we invest in a company called Sundrop Farms. So agricultural space, with some listed agricultural companies, but they're tough because they're volatile. But Sundrop Farms is based near Port Augusta, South Australia, very arid region, grows greenhouse tomatoes, actually supplies 15% of Australia's tomatoes.
Wow.
It uses solar energy to desalinate water to grow the tomatoes in greenhouses.
Clever.
So, incredibly resilient, efficient in terms of resource use, a positive food. That's another challenge for in our ethical screening in the feed sector. You know, what's healthy, what's not. So Yeah, I mean, the unlisted space does open up those individual projects which carry obviously idiosyncratic risk, but, you know, are so important just as proving up concepts which can then be sort of adopted more broadly.
So now we're getting back onto to companies making changes at the corporate level. We were talking about engagement before, and not accusing Woolworths of this, but, you know, kind of greenwashing. There is some moves to make the company look better. Woolworths is interesting, you know, divesting of some key assets. And I imagine on a scoring basis for a lot of ESG research businesses, Woolworths could look better over the other side of this one here. So you just talk about the phenomena of greenwashing, and they're probably talking about Woolworths specifically, how that one's all played out.
And often, you know, it's not a binary thing. That's greenwash, that's not. Investors will have different frameworks and ways for assessing, and that's really important. I mean, it's not just throwing darts at a dartboard. This is part of a professional investment management process. It needs to be consistent, replicable. We're not saying that every responsible investor should reach the same decision about Woolies. I mean, the approach we are taking, and we haven't reached a final decision because we don't know all the detail that we'll need to know. I mean, just recently, so they've established the new entity, which will own all the liquor and gambling assets, but they still own 85% of that, so it's still Woolies. We'll look, okay, so when that gets, whatever happens to that, gets floated off, let's say, we'll look at substance over form, and basically the question is Woolworths still playing a key role in supporting and benefiting from the gambling and alcohol business? And gambling in particular, just such a concern for us both. You know, just poker machines in particular. I mean, it's an area where, Australia leads the world in you know, innovation in machines which can help people lose money quicker than anyone else on the planet.
Yes.
So it's not a great badge of honour, particularly when you put them in pubs, particularly when you have bar staff in pubs who are, you know, giving people more drinks, free drinks to encourage them to stay at the machine. So, you know, there have been some issues which, you know, we hope and we expect Woolworths is addressing as serious issues, but, you know, it rings a lot of alarm bells for us. So so we're going to look at the substance of the change and what will Woolworths end up holding of the new entity, the Endeavour Group. You know, I think they mooted originally last year when they talked about this 30%. You know, is that going to give them some form of sort of effective control? You know, what's the balance of the mix going to look like? They've talked about collaboration agreements, which will be in place between the two groups. What does that look like? Obviously, we're still going to have co-location of lots of liquor stores and Woolies stores.
And probably, you know, they're supply lines as
supply
well.
Supply lines. We're going to have a joint rewards program.
Yeah.
So we would work through all that and say, okay, in substance, do we think, Woolies is still supporting and profiting from activities that we don't like, and then to what extent? And then make a decision based on that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Staying on the company theme as well, we'll talk Royal Commission, you know, kind of wound up throughout 2019, but, you know, a lot of things still continue to happen in that space. Big four banks, they just love hogging the headlines. They keep on wanting to get their names in the headlines. So it's been an interesting year. They've all kind of taken their turns.
Yeah.
So what's your view, or what have you decided on some of the actions at Big Four bank level?
Yeah, so we're in two of the four. We invest in many of the smaller regional banks, but we also are in Westpac and NAB. We're not in CBA and ANZ. It's tough investing in any bank. I mean, the Big Four absolutely have been in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons. And it's appropriate that they're the ones which get the focus. But I mean, one point I would make is we don't take that to mean that the smaller banks are actually on top of all these issues. So we apply similar principles across the sector. Responsible banking we still consider to be positive. It helps individuals, businesses save, invest, manage risk. Importantly, in the context of climate change, you know, the big banks in particular, less so the smaller banks who don't have the capacity, it's key that the big banks are helping get that, you know, trillion of dollars a year that we need globally invested in renewables to transition the energy sector to zero emissions. So it's not something we feel we can just wash our hands of.
You need a shareholder to engage as well, too. That's the other part.
You do, and we do. We do have, a strong dialogue with the banks around, what our expectations are. It's really hard. Quite rightly, a lot of our members, other stakeholders, say, "How can you stay in them?" The way we look at on the climate side, we say basically, are we satisfied you're aligning your lending to renewables, increasing that, reducing your lending to fossil fuels with that transition to net zero emissions? So that's one part of it. The other part on the misconduct side, so, we've had any number of scandals.
Yes.
We ask this really difficult question. Listen, do we think this is systemic and cultural?
Yeah.
Do we think this is... more isolated. It's clearly not one-off, okay? And what does systemic mean? We take into account these are enormous organisations, diverse organisations. So the way we try and approach that is we look at, okay, what do we think about the board and the senior leadership? Are they, when these things go wrong, have they tolerated them? Have they implicitly endorsed them? If we find they do, they're out. So we haven't found that to date with the banks we invest in. The second thing is they might not be doing that, but they might just be presiding over a culture where compliance is sort of viewed as not that important. So that's what we look at as well. Is there evidence that basically within Westpac, for example, in the aftermath of the Austrac scandal, just thought, listen, compliance doesn't matter. Customer doesn't matter, but profit is everything. And when we look at, customer satisfaction ratios, look across all their businesses, the number of customers, the number of complaints, the revenue they earn, the compensation they pay, staff surveys around how they think about compliance, how they feel about their ability to speak up and raise issues. Our conclusion at the moment is that it's not systemic.
Yep.
Now, we keep that under review. Westpac's doing a lot of work internally and the AUSTRAC proceedings will go forward. There'll be more information that'll come out of that, which will update our position.
Take into account. Yep. No, that's good. And again, just to emphasise this point, that you need to get out here and talk about these issues because they are complex, and we really appreciate you giving us an insight to how you approach some of these very difficult situations. So heading towards the end, final question around, I suppose, emerging trends in ESG research and responsible investing. There's, I suppose, food's been another one that's talked around, modern slavery, some new legislation, social media involvement as well. So what are some of the new things that you're thinking about that you're having to, I suppose, educate yourself and others on as emerging trends in this space?
Yeah, so, all those really interesting areas. Food's interesting because it's a good example, I think, when, we're talking about climate change, we need to think beyond the energy sector, transport, real estate, but food. And that means our diet and the way we produce food, the types of food we produce. And obviously food is broader than climate. It's also, resource use of scarce water, environmental impacts of large-scale farming, health impacts of different types of food. We've got a diabetes epidemic. We need to do something to shift diets away from processed sugars. Animal impacts are really important under our charter as well. So animal agriculture, the way that's practiced in virtually any form of large-scale commercial infrastructure causes great animal suffering, including in environments which are becoming much more volatile and exposed to drought and bushfires. We've seen the massive, loss of life of animals, both farm animals and native animals, as a result of the recent bushfires. So, taking that all into account, we reviewed our position. So we don't invest as it stands in animal agriculture. A big effort is looking at because we're satisfied, as the World Health Organization says, that we can have a balanced, healthy diet with which is plant-based, and indeed for most of us, we'll be a lot healthier with that diet. What our challenge in that area is identifying those opportunities in the sustainable food area. I mean, a lot of the listed opportunities are sort of more processed type foods, which don't meet our sort of health requirement. Something like Sundrop Farms, the greenhouse tomatoes, was something we're really excited to get involved in. Yeah. But it's a challenging one. We want to just be part of a conversation where people think about their diet. So we're not out there saying we should all be vegan tomorrow. We're just suggesting that people reflect on how much, where their food comes from, how much animal protein they're consuming, are there alternatives which they could substitute part of that in their diet, and so on. And that's part of what we think is important. You know, investors being more than just allocators of capital, being part of a conversation about not only responsible business practices but also responsible consumption. Yep. So, one obviously is intricately linked to the other.
Correct.
I don't know, social media?
I think we talked about this a couple of years ago as well, because there were a few events at the time. Still very much on the radar, the use of data, what that all means. It's a fascinating area.
It certainly hasn't gone away, has it? Whether it's misinformation, sort of tearing at the fabric of democracy, misuse of our personal information. Mm-hmm. Interesting book called Surveillance Capitalism out there, about how our data is being used in all sorts of different sorts of ways. So we think it's important not to overlook the benefits that the digital economy and social media have delivered to us. I mean, it's sort of easy to say, like lots of products, they're misused, but equally, let's not lose sight of the positive uses around transparency, around access to information. I mean, put yourself back 10 years about how you struggled to find information or work out what was going on, in other parts of the world, or what was going on inside companies.
Yeah, correct.
Suddenly a whole lot of powerful companies, governments are being held to account in ways which are unprecedented. So we don't think the future, the path to a sustainable future around this is throwing it out. The path is, it's a new technology, there's lots of new risks and benefits emerging. We want to see companies collaborating with governments and regulators to chart a sustainable path for these industries. And if we're satisfied there's a legitimate commitment from a company to do that, then we'll stay invested. If we think, no, at the end of the day, they're just going to hang on for grim death to that business model, which is around advertising and hiding basically what they're doing with your data, then we're out. But, there's a lot of action. There's good reason still to be sceptical and cynical, but we're seeing enough that we're staying in the major tech players at this stage.
Cool. Yeah. We'll have to wrap it up there. Thanks, Stu, for coming in again and give us another update in the future about a lot of these very fast-moving issues out there. So we thank you once again for coming in.
Thanks very much, Damon. It's been great.